If a nuclear missile was launched and headed towards Seattle or the Pacific Northwest, would we get a warning? That was the question we tackled on last week's episode of Sound Cues. Long story short, we'd probably get maybe a 15-minute warning. And if you want to hear more about that, listen to last week's episode, where we do a deep dive into the bureaucracy of the Federal Emergency Alert System, and where we play an online game where Anna finds out what would happen if a nuclear missile was headed towards the downtown Seattle Public Library.
It is not pretty, y'all.
It is not pretty. This is Sound Cues, a podcast fueled by listener curiosity. I'm Deborah Wong.
And I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
Anna, I'm curious. What stood out to you about last week's episode?
Okay, so what I found myself talking about over brunch the other day was that if there is a nuclear missile headed our way, we should get into the basement surrounded by concrete and don't go outside, don't get in your car, don't try and find your family after a nuclear attack. Stay put.
Yeah, which is going to probably be the hardest thing for most people to wrap their minds around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that was interesting to me is that, like, basically nobody knows about what you're supposed to do in the event of a nuclear strike. It's just not on anyone's consciousness these days.
Exactly. It seems so vintage, like Cold War, Reagan.
Right. And interestingly enough, here in Washington State, people may even know less than they do in the rest of the country.
Less?
Yeah, that's because we have this very unusual state law that for decades has effectively shut down any planning at the state level to respond to a nuclear strike. But we also have some features in this area that make us a unique target for a nuclear attack. So that's what we're going to take a look at on this week's episode.
Well, that seems like a contradiction. What's the story with the state law?
Well, it's a law that dates back to the 1980s, to the end of the Cold War, when President Ronald Reagan was in office. The former Soviet Union was seen as a real nuclear threat to the United States. At the time, nuclear preparedness was this incredibly divisive political issue. And at the federal level, you had officials in the Reagan administration telling state governments that they had to be ready in case of a nuclear attack, that they had to have emergency and evacuation plans. But some states did not like that mandate, and Washington was one of those states. Lawmakers here decided to push back against the federal government and to put that refusal into law. There's just one sentence in state law that prohibits evacuation planning in the event of a nuclear strike. Now, over the years, that sentence became more broadly interpreted as meaning the state shouldn't do any planning around nuclear strikes. No planning at all, period.
So it's one sentence, it's 40 years old, it's misinterpreted. Why is it around still?
Well, that's a good question. And you're not the only one who's asked it.
My name is David Frocht. I'm the state senator in my third term from Northeast Seattle, Lake Forest Park in Kenmore.
So back in 2017, that's when North Korea test-fired that intercontinental ballistic missile. People here started talking about, like, what would we do in the event of a nuclear attack? And that was when State Senator Frocht happened upon an article in crosscut.com that talked about Seattle as a possible target for North Korea. And then it went on to describe this state law prohibiting evacuation planning for a nuclear strike. Were you aware of this?
No.
Okay, tell me what your reaction was.
Well, my reaction was this is kind of crazy that we're crazy is not the word. I thought it was. Let me put it this way. I thought it was odd that our emergency planners, you know, were somehow precluded by this language.
So Senator Frocht and a colleague tried to change the law to remove the language prohibiting evacuation planning, but they didn't succeed.
So we still have this law?
Yep, it's still on the books.
Okay, so we're still not doing any emergency planning around nuclear strikes?
Pretty much not.
Okay, but let's be real about this. What is the likelihood that we're actually in the sights of North Korea, that we're a target for nuclear annihilation? And if we are, what's the likelihood that North Korea could actually hit us?
Well, that is a really interesting question. Is the Northwest a target for North Korea? Possibly not. But are we a target for other nuclear powers? That answer is yes.
What?
Yeah. And some people say we actually have a big old bullseye on our backs.
Come on.
We will get into that after the break.
You are killing me.
Amazon promises a world of convenience.
But that convenience is changing our lives in ways we might not expect. I'm Carolyn Adolph.
And I'm Joshua McNichols. Amazon's changing parenting.
My youngest child's first full sentence was directed at my Echo Dot.
Senior care.
This thing really had saved my life.
Our homes and our health.
It's all in season 3 of Primed. Find it at KUOW.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
So before the break, we were talking about how the state of Washington has not been planning for nuclear attacks because of a law dating back to the end of the Cold War. State Senator David Frock said the law was odd, and many nuclear experts agree with him, including Hans Christensen. He's the director of the Nuclear Information Program at the Federation of American Scientists.
It's a little strange to hear that they may not be allowed to plan for nuclear attack contingencies, given the fact that they're right next to one of the most important targets in the world.
Did you say one of the most important targets in the world?
Correct, yeah.
What is it? What is he talking about?
He's talking about a lovely bucolic place on the Kitsap Peninsula at the top of Hood Canal, right on the water. It's called the Kitsap Naval Base.
There are 8 ballistic missile submarines operating out of there. And in addition to that, they have an enormous underground nuclear weapons storage site right next to it with well over 1,000 nuclear weapons.
Yeah, more than 1,000 nuclear weapons deep underground in Kitsap Peninsula. That's about 1/3 of all the nuclear weapons in the United States, and it's one of the largest stockpiles anywhere in the world.
You have got to be kidding me.
I am not kidding you. Christensen says the naval base would be an obvious target, as would the underground nuclear weapons facility.
And so an advanced nuclear power that would target it were targeted with nuclear weapons of very high yield that would go off close to the surface to dig up this underground facility, so to speak, and that would create a colossal amount of radioactive fallout. So that is a very dirty form of attack that would happen up there, I'm sure.
So an advanced nuclear power, who is that?
Well, he's not talking about North Korea. There seems to be a consensus among people I spoke with that North Korea's nuclear missile capabilities may still be somewhat primitive. The thought is that its missiles are not that accurate, so they would likely look to a big target that they can't miss, like maybe Los Angeles, rather than a small target like a nuclear submarine base. So the advanced nuclear powers that could really damage these facilities, we're talking about Russia and China.
And is the naval base likely the only target?
Well, there are other military facilities in the region, and there are economic targets like Boeing, Microsoft, even Amazon. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the Seattle Times had a story about an obscure communications facility up in Snohomish County that Russian military strategists have said is a target. It's a facility that communicates with submarines out on the ocean, so it plays a pretty important role. But there's really no way to know for sure because Russia and China are not sharing their target lists with us, obviously.
Okay, so we've established that we likely have a target on our backs, and we have established that we have no idea what to do in the event of a nuclear strike. So what should we be doing? Are there people arguing that we should start planning, even though this is a really remote possibility?
Well, it depends on who you ask. So Barb Graff is the head of emergency management for the city of Seattle. Her biggest concerns these days are not nuclear Armageddon. They're the more frequent events like snow emergencies, power outages, and then less frequent but potentially devastating events like earthquakes. So she wants people to get better prepared for those disasters that are more likely to happen. And she says emergency officials have to walk this very fine line. On the one hand, they want to make sure people understand the risks so that they can get ready. But on the other hand, there is such a thing as too much and too scary information, because that actually turns people off.
We conducted focus groups years ago about the wide variety of disasters that could befall us here in Seattle in order to figure out what are the words that we should use that make people take action and not just scare them away. What type of messaging is the most effective? What agencies should you hear it from, et cetera? And when we got to talking about things like nuclear blast or terrorist incidents, we just lost people. They just tuned it out and said, if that's going to happen, that's my time. I don't want to hear anything more.
So Barb Graff says if they're going to talk about any big, scary thing, they're going to focus on something that's more likely to happen, like a big megathrust earthquake. Okay, now you get a different view from Alex Wellerstein. He's the nuclear history professor and the nuke map creator. He says people should be focusing on preparation for nuclear strikes, or at least they shouldn't ignore the threat entirely, because even though the Cold War is over, like it or not, the nuclear powers still have thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at each other, and we could still obliterate each other, theoretically. So he says, first of all, people should learn the basics about how to protect themselves. And secondly, when they think about those scenarios, they almost by default get more engaged in issues of nuclear weapons, which he says is a really good thing.
The cognitive work that you do in thinking about what you would do to be prepared is also the same cognitive work that would make you a more engaged citizen on these issues, which might help you, say, ask questions of your next representative or your senator whenever they go up for re-election and get them to take a firm position on how they feel about certain nuclear developments or something like that, which could ultimately lead to a safer world as well.
Wow. We've really gone a lot of places with this story.
Indeed.
At the end of all of this, Deb, how do you feel about this story? You know, do you think that we should do more to prepare for a nuclear strike?
I think I do, because, you know, I grew up in that generation where we experienced that fear and nightmares about nuclear war and movies like The Day After. And, you know, in my experience, that fear gave way to basically nothing. I mean, people stop thinking about nuclear weapons. And again, my kids have almost no consciousness of what they are. So the reality, though, is that there are still thousands of them out there, and they're pointed at targets, you know, like us, and people are not thinking about them, which is in itself kind of scary, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I come down on the side of Alex Wellerstein, the nuclear expert.
Mm-hmm.
I think knowing some basic things about weapons and what they do and how to protect yourself is just not a bad idea.
Yeah. So for people like me who didn't grow up in the Cold War, where should we go to learn more about what we should do?
Well, we're going to put up a bunch of links on the web version of these stories at kuow.org/soundcues. And because I grew up during the Cold War, I have a lot of movies about nuclear war that I really enjoy. I mean, that sounds so weird, but they're surprisingly a lot of fun. So you can check out that list as well.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Deb.
And if you have a question about Seattle or our region, head over to our website, kuow.org/soundcues, and drop us a note. Or call us at 206-616-3805 and leave us a voicemail. Your question might be featured in a future episode.
Sound Cues is a production of KUOW in Seattle. Kyle Norris is our producer. Jeannie Yandel is our editor.
Our production team includes Catherine Banwell, Gil Agutter, Caroline Chamberlain Gomez, Jill Jackson, and Brendan Sweeney. Michael Parker composed our theme music.
I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
And I'm Deborah Wong.
Thanks for listening.